This is the Smallmouth Crush Podcast. If you're a hardcore angler, you've come to the right place. This is a weekly podcast that will interview some of the top smallmouth bass anglers in North America. Travis and his guest will discuss what it takes to consistently catch big smallmouth, and you'll get a glimpse inside the mind of a trophy smallmouth angler. And now, here's your host of the Smallmouth Crush Podcast, Travis Manson.
Hello, welcome to the Smallmouth Crush Podcast. My name is Travis Manson. Here it is, another week talking smallmouth fishing. Why wouldn't you, right? We love big old smallmouth. And we got a Canadian as our guest today. David Chong's going to visit with us, and we're going to get inside his head, find out what it takes to consistently put big smallmouth in the boat. So I'm really looking forward to this episode. But before we do that, let's talk about the Real Shot. Of course, they carry all the most wanted bass tackle that a smallmouth crush fan could ask for. Top brands like Megabass, Jackal, Evergreen, Z-Man, Daiwa, Shimano, Dirty Jigs, Kitex, you name it. They got it all. You guys know the drill. Head on over to therealshot.com. Use my code SmallmouthCrush15 and get 15% off your first order. So pretty cool. Head on over. Let them know Smallmouth Crush sent you. There's David. How are you?
Oh, I'm awesome, Travis. Super excited to be talking about smallmouth bass.
Right. No, it's a pleasure. I'm glad to have you on this podcast. You certainly know how to catch big smallmouth living up in Canada. You know, for people that are not familiar, David, with you, could you just give us a quick intro, kind of your background, in your experience as far as, you know, where your love for smallmouth has taken you, you know, up until now?
Sure. Well, I've been doing tournaments up here for, well, I probably closer to 30 years than not. So I've been doing it for a fairly long time. Fished all the major tournaments up here anyways. And, you know, we've been down to a few, team championships and federation championships down in the States as well. So I've done some fishing down there, but smallmouth has always been, even before I did tournaments, it was probably one of my favorite fish to fish for. It's kind of funny because when I started doing tournaments, it was still pretty much dominated by largemouth up here. And I had to really focus on learning largemouth better. And then as the years gone on, if you're not fishing smallmouth on almost, there's very few bodies of water up here. If you're not fishing smallmouth, you're not fishing to win anymore. So, it's a whole new world out there as far as smallmouth bass fishing. Love it. And of course, I'm lucky to be up here where I'm like literally 25 minutes from Lake Simcoe. Mm. So, and of course, you know, we have the St. Lawrence River, Lake St. Clair, Lake Erie, Lake Ontario. So I'm just lucky to be able to fish some of the best smallmouth fisheries in the world.
A lot of options.
Yeah. Yep.
Wow. So what do you consider like your home body of water?
Do you know what? I would probably consider Simcoe, although the last few years, I honestly have not gotten a chance to fish very often because I've a lot of the tournaments I've been doing takes me out toward the St. Lawrence River, Lake St. Francis, Lake Ontario, and actually down to Erie even. Not as many big events on Simcoe as there used to be. We've had a few major events up there. I honestly can't remember what year it was, but we probably had the biggest tournament in Canadian tournament history on Lake Simcoe, the New Ark Open, which was won by Mike DeForge, who's another phenomenal, you know, smallmouth angler up here, where, you know, first place was $100,000, second place was $50,000, and I don't know if we'll ever see those days again up here, but it'd be nice. But a lot of my time is actually spent out east now. So St. Lawrence River, Lake St. Francis, Lake Ontario, love those bodies of water. I get on them whenever I can, that's for sure.
Why do you think you prefer that, you know, fishing that style, St. Lawrence River, it versus, you know, some of the inland lakes and Simcoe or maybe even Lake Erie? What gravitates towards that zone?
I don't know if I would say I prefer to fish that style, but that tends to be, you know, where the tournaments that, you know, I'm entered in or the bigger tournaments happen to be. So that's what I, you know what, I'll tell you what, I fish some small bodies of water when I don't have to be at tournaments and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to catch a 5-pounder on a little pond, 5-pound smallie, that's incredible. You know, that's the same as catching a 7 out in, you know, St. Lawrence or on Lake Ontario or, well. So yeah. I wouldn't say I prefer it. It's okay. It's just what it is, you know.
It's where the schedule takes you.
Exactly.
So if you could, you know, describe your perfect scenario, time of year, technique, if you could go out and target smallmouth and you could pick exactly the conditions and what bait and where you're at, what's the ideal? Wow, I love it. I'm loving it. I'm having fun today and we're catching them. What are you looking for?
Wow. You know what? Anytime I'm fishing for smallmouth is incredible. Mm-hmm. And I'm gonna put out a scenario out there. Up here, early season, we have a late start to our season up here, primarily because, you know, they're trying to protect the fish while they're spawning, enable them to get their annual thing done. But you know, that spawn period, that can be the most incredible fishing you can imagine. Of course, I'm always, being a conservationist as well, I'm always torn between that. It's so much fun, but is it the best thing for the fishery, right? Mm-hmm. So if it was just for fun, that'd be the most fun, but mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the best time. Other than that, the fall fishing is incredible. That's one of the times up here when you got a chance at a true giant, you know, a record, you know, and you could have number days, you know. We fish Erie a lot in the fall. You know, 100 fish days are, you know, fairly common, you know, and probably, you know, I'd say 60 to 70% of those fish are probably going to be 4 pounds or better.
Oh, wow.
So that's hard to take. And then in the fall on Lake Simcoe, you know, we used to have a tournament in late October, unfortunately, because of COVID and stuff. You know, we haven't had it for a couple of years, or hopefully it'll come back this year. But, you know, it was nothing to take, you know, 31 pounds to win that tournament, you know. So you had to average over 6 pounds a fish in order to win it. And, you know, of course, my personal best was caught in the fall in Simcoe. So,
you know, what was your personal best?
8.7.
Whoa, hold on. 8.7.
Oh yeah, it was a ridiculous fish. It was, you know, when I first hooked it, I honestly thought I hooked a lake trout, because at that time of year they kind of cross over, because lake trout are fall spawners. So a lot of times where you're fishing, you run into lake trout constantly, and I really thought I hooked a lake trout when I first hooked it. And I should tell you the story about catching, because it is pretty funny. So I had a friend of mine who was actually my tournament partner this year for the Renegade Circuit, Steve Navol, with me. And he hadn't fished Simcoe very often. And so he said, well, you know, do you mind taking me out? And, you know, I'd like to try it out a little bit more. And I said, sure, let's go out. So we went out, and it was, it would have been, I think, the third week in October. It was probably third week of October, and we went out there and we launched the boat, and he came down to the boat, and I go, ah, damn, I left the net in the back of the truck. I go, do you mind running back up and grabbing it? He says, sure. So he goes running back up to the truck, comes down. I happen to have two nets in the back, my regular bass net, which is already a big net. And of course I had a pike net in the back there, which is really big. And he comes trotting down with the pike net. And right. I'm looking at him, I'm going, okay, I guess you think we're going to catch a really big fish today. And we got in the boat and we went off and we went out and fished, and it wasn't a great day. It was probably about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I think we had caught like maybe 5 or 6 fish. And the biggest one was probably about 5.5. I know to a lot of people that's a big fish, but at that time of year, it's just another 5 pounder. It sounds ridiculous, but you know, and I was long lining a deep diving jerkbait, and I hooked this fish. I was probably about 27 feet down over about 40 feet. And I hooked this fish. And like I said, when I set hook into it, it never came up. So I thought, and I felt the weight on it. I thought, oh man, I got a Laker. I'm fighting it. And it goes down, you know, and it comes, I get it close to the boat, and all of a sudden we see it down there because it's super clear there. And I'm going, oh, it's a smallie. Oh, that's a nice one. It's got to be 5-6 pounds. And then as I'm fighting it and coming up, well, it keeps getting bigger and bigger. and then all of a sudden it decides it wants to jump or trying to jump.
Sure.
It comes kind of half wallow out of the water. You know, when they're too fat to actually clear the water. Follow the one and go, oh my God. And then going, get the net there. And Steve gets the net, puts it underneath. We get in the boat and we literally both stand over it, staring down at it and going, how big is that thing?
Yeah.
Because Simcoe's an incredible body of water for big fish. That would have been at that point, that would have, I think, was my 39th smallie over 7 pounds out of Simcoe. Wow. So he goes, how big is that thing? I go, I don't know. I just know it's bigger than any smallmouth I've ever caught. And I've caught, I think at that point, my biggest one would have been like 7.6 or something.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going, but I don't have a scale on board. Because you know, in tournaments, we beam all our fish. When we come in a tournament, like when we had the B1 and stuff, if you ask me how much, I said, well, I think we have like whatever, 22 or whatever, but I don't really know because we don't weigh them.
Sure.
All I can tell you is I have my best 5 fish in the boat. So I'm going, oh my God. Okay. Okay. You might have to drive to Cabela's and buy a scale because we got to weigh this thing. And then I realized a friend of mine was guiding that day and we saw him earlier on. I said, well, he'll have a scale for his clients, right? For sure. So we ran out, we found him, we got the scale and we weighed it. And like I said, 8.7 on the digital scale. And so we got a couple of quick pictures, let her recover in the live well and we let her go. But the thing was when we actually netted the fish and put it on, when we were looking down at it and staring down at it, he looked at me and he looked up and he says, yep. And that's why I brought the big net.
Right. So what would be the record for that? I don't know how you have it by prop. You know, is it?
I think in a tournament, we did have one year in the fall that was, I think it was an 8.6 maybe. Unofficially, I don't know if that was the biggest one. There's been every year there's more and more. Mm-hmm. 8-plus pounders that are being caught, you know.
Do you think there's a 9-pounder living there?
I think there's a 10-pounder.
Wow.
We've only had gobies in there since 2012, I do believe. So not nearly as long as Erie's had gobies. So that additional food source with those invasive gobies in there, the fish have just, I think, are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I do believe there's a double-digit fish in there.
Wow, yeah.
And she'll be caught one day. Hopefully, I'm the one who catches
right, her. Hopefully. your next personal best. It's hard to beat that. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if it can be done. Man, what's the predominant pattern? You know, you mentioned you caught that fish pretty deep. Is there opportunities for shallow fishing as well as deep there? Or how's that lake really laid out?
Yeah, during the rest of the season, you can almost always catch shallow fish. In fact, one of the things I found out during the summer years and years ago, when it got really, really hot, some of those big fish just go so shallow. Mm. Like you wouldn't think, honestly, I've been out there in the summer when I've had like 78, 80 degree surface temps, and you would think, oh, these fish have all gone deep. And you go shallow and here are these big black girls all over the place, you know? So for sure there's opportunity to catch them shallow as well in the fall, especially later in the fall, like into October and early November and stuff like that. Deep is where they're at, you know?
Okay.
Yeah. Occasionally you'll get it. Like I know a few, like our Thanksgiving is in October, and we've had a few Thanksgiving Day weekends where we just had an incredible mild spell, and I've seen them move up shallow and at that time as well. But for the most part in the fall, you're looking for them deep.
Right. Right. What would you say your favorite technique or favorite way to fish for smallmouth would be?
Whatever's catching them that day.
Yeah.
I honestly, you know, if I had to, I love throwing a jerkbait. I can cover a lot of water. I can trigger fish with it. My personal biggest fish came off of a jerkbait, but, you know, I've caught a lot of big fish on jerkbaits. And I think a jerkbait is a big fish, presentation. That being said, how can you argue with throwing a topwater for smallmouth?
Mm-hmm.
It may not always be as productive, but you can't argue how much fun it is when they're smashing topwaters, you know.
Right.
But if you made me choose one, I'd say a jerkbait.
Jerkbait. Yeah. All right, let's dig into that, because a lot of people that chase smallmouth are learning about smallmouth. That's one of the prime. You know, that's a bait you have to have in your box. Mm-hmm. Are you running a variety of different jerk baits, or depending on the situations, do you gravitate towards certain brands, colors? Can you kind of give us a quick, your crash course when it comes to jerk baiting?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you know, what I tell most people when we talk about jerk baits is everything about jerk baiting is about compromise. There is no perfect jerkbait rod. There's no perfect line to use. You're compromising on everything. You're just trying to, you know, best one for that situation. Like, for instance, the way you work a jerkbait with that downward stroke, a shorter rod is obviously easier for you to work a bait. But when you hook that big fish, it's not the best rod to be fighting that fish with. You know, I actually had a friend here, and if he watches this, he'll know who I'm talking about, and other people probably do, who supposedly designed this perfect jerkbait rod, and it was 5.5 feet long. And it was, if you were just worrying about working the bait, if you weren't worried about landing fish, if you just wanted to put a nice, you know, walk the dog action to it, it worked great. Mm-hmm. But when you hooked a big fish on a 5.5 foot rod, especially if you're using lighter line, you're going to lose a lot of fish. So, you know, as far as a rod goes, I run a 610, a medium action, a little bit more parabolic than a normal rod. I do throw my jerk baits on a spinning rod. I know a lot of people do still throw them on bait casters. For me, it's more that I've had, you know, some elbow issues in the past. Mm-hmm. And the spinning rod's a lot easier for me to work the bait. It's hard on, you know, it's hard for bait caster. But as far as, you know, jerk baits and stuff like that, yeah, I use different ones for different situations. I use, ones that, you know, regular jerk baits, which probably dive down to like a 110 size and dives down to about, you know, 5, 6, 7 feet maybe. And then sometimes we'll go to deeper diving jerk baits, like the one I caught that other one. You know, like long lining it out there. But
can you talk about that technique, the long lining of a jerk bait? Because you mentioned you believe that bait was down 27 feet,
yep.
Or that fish was the bait was.
No, the bait was around 27 right. feet. I do believe
we're gonna have to talk about that.
How
are you doing that?
Okay, so up here in Canada, it's a presentation which we refer to as strolling. And we've had a lot of discussion up here how legal it is, because it's a lot of people look at it and say you're trolling. But we've had a number of organizations up here look at it, and they said, you know, as long as you're not just holding your rod there and pulling the bait along with the boat, you know, as long as you put some action to it yourself and impart some action. And we do, we will jerk on it and, you know, occasionally and, you know, we'll play with the bait a bit, and that's the only way you're going to get it down that deep, is you're going to have a lot of line out in order to do it. I think most circuits down in the States wouldn't even allow that.
Right.
I know when they talk about strolling, they, you know, it's casting your bait out opening your bail, moving your boat away, and then start retrieving your lure, right? But in this case, that's strolling up here.
Sure.
Now I really only do that in the fall. That's the only time because they're deep, right?
Yeah. No, that's really fascinating because, first of all, a lot of times, especially in the fall, when you're trying to fish deep and you're over a big concentration of fish that might be way down there, it's hard to get any type of reaction bait. You know, maybe a swim bait. Or, you know, a horizontal presentation sometimes is very difficult. And a lot of these, you know, for me, I like to go out and catch fish. I'm not fishing a tournament in the fall. And a lot of our listeners and viewers just want to go wreck on some big smallmouth. So I think that's a genius idea. Mm-hmm. If you want to go out and have some fun and get that jerk bait down there. So I'm just going to because I've never really experimented with it too much. I have a little bit, but I'm assuming you get over the structure that you want. You make a long cast. You're opening your bail and you're basically taking your trolling motor and moving that quickly away from that bait, right? Yep. So you want a bunch of line out there and then you start working that bait. And because there's so much line and distance, that bait's getting down deeper, obviously, right?
Yep.
And like how much line do you think between your rod and the bait could there be? I mean, are you 100 yards out?
Yeah. Some cases. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. 100 yards is not. Not uncommon.
Yep. Sure. Very cool.
It is an interesting presentation, and we did keep it quiet for a while up here, but you know, it pretty well is a known known presentation now. I saw your podcast with Scott Dobson, and I think he was talking about he thought the Johnsons were doing that at some point up on Lake Simcoe, and it's very possible because it is a presentation that is used quite often up here.
That's awesome. That's something to think about for sure, especially when you're getting into those zones. It's got to be frustrating when you take the time to line up a cast and don't get bit and you got to redo it again. It seems like it's pretty time consuming, but you're typically around these fish that are pretty, there's a lot of activity, I would assume, especially.
Yeah, we know what kind of structure they're on and chances are we've already been marking them on the, on our sonars or, you know, prior to actually, you know, working the structure.
Sure.
Like I said, that's only the fall. Otherwise, just casting and, the walk the dog action, you know, big smallies have a hard time resisting that, although they can be finicky at time. And, you know, I'm sure you have had it when they can frustrate you and they can follow and they won't. They won't commit. But you know, that's when you can, you know, you have to change things up. You got to change your presentation sometimes, you know, if you can, you know, if you're working, you know, with most Japanese jerk baits, at least I find if you're working it hard and you stop and you got a fish following it, if you snap upwards and it takes a bit of practice, but you snap upwards on it, actually you can cause the bait to spin around. And I've had people watch me do that and they're like in total awe, but I've been doing it for so long. And it turns around and it's almost when that bait turns around and faces that fish gets really pissed off and it actually eats it, you know, a good number of the time anyways, not every time, but there's different things you can do. You can speed up the bait, you can slow it down, you know, you can pause it, there's other things I do to jerk baits that I used to always run a feathered trailer.
Okay.
I don't know if you do or not, but you know, I used to always run a feathered trailer. I thought that was by far a key triggering mechanism, you know, especially when you pause it and it's suspending in there and that feathered trailer is kind of just pulsing like that. And sometimes that's a triggering mechanism, but I actually had an incident or a tournament up on Georgian Bay, and I realized that feather was actually hurting me.
Really?
It was. I've never experienced that before, so I can't say I always use it now. There's a time and a place. I probably use it the majority of the time. But what was happening was these fish, and I could see these fish coming in, and they'd be following it, and they weren't really, really aggressive. But they were very fixated on the feather. And almost every fish I hooked, especially the big ones, like the 4 or 5 pounders, just grabbed the back hook because they were so fixated on the feather. And I ended up, I think I lost like 4 that were probably in that 4.5 to 5 pound range. We would have probably won the tournament hands down if we landed those fish. But, you know, I took the feather off. I went back out there the next day and they were in the same kind of mood and I had the same thing. And I actually took the feather off. And when I took the feather off, I was almost every fish was eating the whole bait, and because they weren't fixated on that feather in the back. So, you know, these are things you just learn from being out in the water, and it's not something that happens all the time.
Right.
But you might be aware that things are, don't work the same way every day out there. So every day it could be different. It could be a different cadence that triggers them. Right.
Right. When it comes to color choices, there's so many different colors on the market. You have your range of, you know, almost see-through or translucent baits to bone colors to some crazy colors, right? Hot pink and yellow chartreuse. Where do you find yourself gravitating towards to start? Is it?
I got basically two colors that I would start with almost every time in any body of water. And that's like a chartreuse shad type of thing, or what a lot of companies call a pro blue bone, where it's got kind of like a bone pattern on it, and it's got a blue. Those are almost my go tos. I'll start with. I probably carry 20 colors,
right?
Because if you're a smallmouth fisherman, it's just like we can say, oh, I prefer this color tube, but you probably do have 20 other color tubes with you as well. Mm-hmm. So I do carry other ones, but those are the two I almost always start with and kind of go from there.
Any crazy colors? Have you seen a difference sometimes when you go with like a clown versus a natural? I know I've experienced that a handful of times. It's not something, and it might be just body of water too. You know, oftentimes you'll go to a body of water and you'll hear buzzwords if you're doing some research where, you know, the clown keeps coming up. Well, you might want to throw clown if on that particular place. Have you experienced anything like that?
I get them on clown. Clown's actually, you know, probably in that, it's not in the A group, but it's probably in that B group, just below it.
Hot pink.
I was just going to say, I had one time when they were on a pink jerkbait, and I honestly have never had them on it again, I did that time. But that one time, and they just wouldn't bite anything. I go, what the hell? Well, we were just out fun fishing anyways. And I threw on the pink, and they were just, I don't know what about it. Mm. You know, there's nothing out in nature there that looks that color.
Right.
And exactly. I don't know if it made them mad or what, but they were eating like crazy. And I've tried it a few other times since then when they weren't biting really well. And I've actually never been able to duplicate that day again.
Right.
So
right.
I don't carry a lot of pink ones with me.
Sure. Sure. are you throwing jerk baits year round?
Yep. Yep.
You are. Yep.
Yep. Yep. All year long. That's always a rod that's rigged up when we're fishing anywhere where there's smallmouth.
Sure. Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah. Some bodies of water, like some of the inland bodies of water where, you know, the forage is more like a perch base rather than a herring or shad based forage, then the perch finishes are always great choices in those bodies of water.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Dave, this was fascinating on the jerkbait. I'm sure a lot of our listeners just picked up a bunch of good stuff to take to the water. I know I certainly did. I want to talk, time's flying here when you're talking fishing. So I want to make sure we cover a few other things.
Sure.
When it comes to smallmouth fishing, but I know you're really big into electronics and locating fish, with electronics. I want you to kind of walk us through if you were just preparing for, an event, a tournament, or just going out to a new body of water, and we're talking, you know, a deeper pattern where it might be summer and you know they're offshore, where do you typically like to start or look, and how much do you rely on your electronics when you are looking for those fish?
Well, when it comes to smallmouth bass fishing, electronics is these days is almost everything. I know if you're largemouth fishing, you can probably get away without, without electronics. And occasionally some bodies of water where the smallies are shallow. But even then, the things you can do with the forward facing, sonar, the live scope from Garmin, it's incredible. What I usually look for if I'm going to a new body of water, first of all, we start by looking at Google Earth and Navionics charts well before we ever get to that body of water. And I love going to new bodies of water. That's one of the things we love about going down to like the team championship, which we've done every year, is every year we go to a different body of water, and it's always cool to try to figure things out, right? Mm-hmm. But look for spawning areas, flats where we fish would spawn, and then where would they go after that? And of course, depending on the time of year, where they're heading from there. And then once we've done that, we'll drop some waypoints that we're going to go check out, whether it's whether they're mid lake shoals or particularly steep drops or just nice sand flats, mm-hmm. We'll mark all those down so we can check those all out when we get in the body of water. And I think there's been so many technological changes over the, I remember when like side imaging first came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh my God, instead of going over a point with your traditional 2D sonar and doing this weaving really tight, now you do like, instead of doing maybe a dozen kind of crosses over it, you might do three. And with a side imaging, you can see all the structure and the boulders, and mm-hmm. You see a boulder in your side imaging and you scroll over to it, and you whoop, and there's a waypoint on it. It's like, I thought that was just incredible. And then of course the detail you get in the down imaging now or clear view, depending on what company you're with and everything. Mm-hmm. It's like a picture. It's no longer just a sonar view. If it looks like a tree, it is a tree. It mm-hmm. looks actually like a tree.
Right.
And then when Garmin introduced the original Panoptix, I thought, oh, this is unbelievable. And then I think like it was only 2 years and they came out with LiveScope.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where it's going to go with electronics. Honestly, I guess it's getting to the point now, when you look at our boats and I'm sure there's people out there who don't like hearing this, but when you've just in your electronics alone, you've got like $20,000 in electronics mm-hmm. on your boat.
Yeah.
To go fishing,
it is crazy.
Sometimes we do. I sit there and go, "This is crazy." But mm-hmm. but if you want to make your time in the water the most productive as possible, you need those electronics. You need to see, that live scope. It changes everything. It's like it gives you a camera in front of your boat. You can see how the fish reacts to your bait. That's the thing with 2D sonar. Even if you're fishing over them, if we were drop shotting or thing, you can see there's a fish there, you can maybe see your bait and all of a sudden the fish is gone or whatever, or it eats it or whatever. You don't mm-hmm. know. But if you're watching it on either Panoptix or Panoptix live scope, you can actually see the reaction of the fish to what you're doing with your bait. It's such an eye opener. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. And there's time. Well, being up in Canada, you 3 or 4 months of the year we have to go ice fishing.
Right, right.
So I can relate from this past winter, being out there for fishing some walleye.
Sure.
And we had these fish coming in, and if you had a traditional sonar, you saw them come in, you're trying to catch them and they would come, they look, and then they just swim away. Right. And then we had the Panoptix out and I had a lipless crankbait. We were fishing like 30 feet down over 52 and this fish would come in and all of a sudden you see the fish there. And of course, you're trying to lift it or you're trying to trigger a bite. You're shaking it a little bit, get the rattles going. And every time we did this, we actually watched the fish turn around and leave. And then we would stop, hold the rod and not move it at all. And you actually watch the fish turn back around, because it's got like a 135 degree cone angle, right? As opposed to your 2D sonar, which might have an 8 or a 10 degree cone angle. So you can see so much more. Mm-hmm. And it would come, and then it's coming back, and you start shaking, and you lift, and it would turn and swim away.
Huh. Right.
And they said, so after the second time it did that, next time we held it and it came back, we watched it come back around. And when it came back around, just held it there, didn't move it. And we watched the fish actually circle the bait, and then all of a sudden it just sitting there, and then it smashed it.
Hmm.
And then after that, we were able to duplicate that up with almost every fish that came in.
So and you would have been able to do that without live scope.
Yeah, with traditional TDE sonar, we would not have been able to understand what the fish was doing. And that's the key. If you know how the fish is reacting to your lure, obviously you can figure out what's going to trigger them, right?
Wow.
So
yeah,
it's going to be real interesting in the next few years where this all goes, you know, with right. technology and electronics. You know, the funny thing is all the people up here look at the cost of like the live scope and, you know, the other Lowrance is coming out with their version, or I think they just released it, and everybody's going, oh, that's crazy money. You bass fishermen are nuts.
Hmm.
Do you know who's even crazier for that stuff?
Hmm.
The crappy fishermen.
Oh, right. Sure.
Holy crap. Down there?
Yep. Yeah.
Down in the States, every crappy guy has live scope.
They do.
And they don't think twice about spending the money on it because they know what it does for them.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why I laugh at some people up here, because they think, you bass people are nuts. Mm-hmm. I'm going, yeah, but we're fishing in tournaments for some pretty big money, you know, and thing. I'm going, what if you were just out fun fishing for crappie for dinner and you were spending that kind of money?
Yeah. Well, and that's how I look at it. When I get to go out fishing, I want to, I've had conversations with buddies and stuff about this, kind of what you're saying. It's so expensive for all this electronics and whatnot, but I want to go out there and set the hook, man. I don't want to waste my time. And so it allows you to, what we love to do, catch fish. Yes, being out in nature and the water, that's all great and good. But when you go out there every day, man, I want to set the hook on these fish. And those electronics are going to be able to help you. And just because you have them on your boat, you still got to – there's still a lot more to the puzzle. This just helps you really fine-tune things, make sure you're on the right track. Of course, you know, just because you have $20,000 electronics, you can't go anywhere on the lake and the fish just show up. You got to go search for them. Yeah. And now you have that opportunity to do that, because there's so much going on. You know, the problem is
I'm learning new stuff with the live scope every time I'm out in the water.
Yeah.
You know, there's something I figure out, or, you know, play with different settings and you might see more, you know, and or discover, you know, new applications for it, right? It's not always as simple as this is all it's good for. It's there's a lot of options. The other thing is, the other big thing with technology wise is, what did you run for a trolling motor last year, Travis?
Yeah, so I had the Garmin Force last year, brushless. Before that, it was always an Ultrex. I've had motor guides. I've ran them all.
But that brushless motor, that is like just incredible. Never mind the power in it, how quiet it is, how much running time you get. With smallmouth, and this is something I do want to talk about, because we're talking about technology here, is this past summer, whenever I've been, you know, either on my boat with the Force, or, you know, I actually have some friends who are running a Ghost as well from Lowrance, another brushless motor. And in the past, a lot of times, if you're fishing shallow, you see a smallie, chances are you spook them with the trolling motor and everything. They're already on guard. They're not as eager to bite and everything. We've been able with brushless motors actually follow smallies, and it's almost like they don't even know we're there. I don't know if you had seen that. You know, they weren't spooked at all. They were just, you know, and
I've noticed a huge difference. It would be hard for me to go back to the old technology when it comes to a trolling motor. Nothing wrong with the Ultrex, but it was a workhorse, and it did what it was supposed to. But not only is it quieter, but you also don't get as much interference. In the past, I would have so, and it wasn't consistent. You know, some days the graph would be perfect, and the next day, you know, when you hit that button on the trolling motor, that you're not going to be able to see any fish down there until you take your foot off the button. Oh, and yeah. Now we don't have that anymore.
Yeah. One of my partners, when we're in his boat, every time we step on the trolling motor, it's we basically are blind.
Sure. Well,
he says he can read through the interference, but I'm not convinced of that. You know.
Well, I think as we move forward, there's going to be so many different opportunities. And here's another thing too: there's a lot of good videos out there on setting up your graphs, and there's one common thing I see, and that everyone has a different opinion when it comes to the right settings, whether it be the color palette. I find that really interesting. You know, I'm the type of guy that wants the best answer, the best solution to everything. And my research has shown that I think it really is what your interpretation is with that graph and being able to become intimate with it, if you will. Because once you start using it, you start seeing different things and your bait differently. And of course, the fish. And there's so many different palettes and settings that you can experiment with that might be right for you, where the next guy has a little bit. I love the yellow setting on my Garmin. And I'll have guys that come in the boat and they just can't deal with it at all.
Yeah. I think everybody's eyes are a little different too, Travis. So I think you got to find what works for you. You know, that's why they offer so many different palettes, right? It's not as simple as, oh, this is amber is the only one to use or yellow is the only one to use. You know, it's what works for your eyes. And but it's changing. I can't, it's hard to describe. There's so many situations. Well, I can give you a clear one, which really will blow your mind.
Yeah.
As far as how important something like LiveScope is. So we, obviously, when I fish the Renegade Circuit, which is the Eastern Ontario circuit, we usually almost always have one event on Lake St. Francis and one event on the St. Lawrence River. So this year, I do believe the winning weight on Lake St. Francis, because it's not in the fall or early season, so I do believe it was like around 23 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put it that way. And which for in the middle of the summer is a pretty good weight, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a smaller body of water, which is on the Rideau system called Newborough. And in the past, my partner and I have won this with 18 and change. And most of the time, if you're in that 18 pound range, you got a chance at winning this tournament here. Well, one team happened to get on the mother load using LiveScope. And they were fishing, I do believe, if I recall correctly, over 60 something feet. And they were spotting these fish that were literally just under the surface and catching them on top water and jerk baits and stuff like that with their LiveScope. And they weighed over 24 pounds.
Wow.
I could have made a lot of money if in the spring I put out a bet there that the winning weight on Newborough would be bigger than the winning weight on Lake St. Francis. Everybody would have taken that bet from me and they would have lost.
Yeah.
We've never seen weights like that. And that I do believe another circuit had a classic there. And I do believe the team that ended up winning it, and they weighed 23 one day, 24 the next day. And this is a small inland body of water. This is not, not connected to the Great Lakes. It's not part of Lawrence.
In the past, these fish were, the easiest way to fish for them was to look for structure and fish on the bottom. And maybe people didn't even understand, just idling with their 2 days. They never saw these fish, right?
You wouldn't have even known those fish were there.
Yeah.
You know, when they're suspended, it's so hard. And without that LiveScope, you would never know they're there. You would never know, how to catch them, etc. It's mind boggling, the differences.
Great stuff, David. We are running out of time. I got to ask you one final question. We'd like to ask everybody that comes on. And I'm going to need a straight answer from you. Okay. If I could give you, I give you one bait to use next season for the whole year to catch smallmouth. You only get one bait. What are you going to tie on?
Everywhere.
Everywhere. I know it. I'm sorry, but that's the question.
Oh boy.
We need an answer.
You know what? I'd have to go with a jerk bait, you know.
Really?
That says something. I do love throwing my jerk bait, but you know, it's a theoretical question, right, there, right. but there's, in reality, smallmouth fishing, every body of water is going to be different, and what you're going to be throwing for them is going to be different. But if I had to choose one,
it would be a jerk bait. We got to take it one step further. I need to know the brand. Can you give us that?
Well, okay. I use a bunch of different brands.
Right.
The one I played with last year and had a lot of success with, I still use the other ones. So I was with Lucky Craft for many years, and big Lucky Craft fan still.
Sure.
And I think Mega Bass makes great baits. But the one that, you know what, if I had to only pick one, I'd probably still pick a Lucky Craft.
Okay.
You know, Pointed 100 is all
well rounded.
It was the first jerk bait I ever, first Japanese jerk bait I ever got. I was out traveling California many years ago, and somebody convinced me to buy one, I think at like $30 US at that time. And literally that was like 25 years ago. And that was a lot of money for a jerk bait. And I know that bait so intimately. I know exactly what I can do with it. I know exactly how to make it, you know, spin around exactly that day. But last year, Yuzuri did introduce a 110 jerk bait in their 3DB lineup. And I'm just hoping they expand their colors. They got some great colors, but I think they need a few more.
Okay.
But the bait itself, for what's retail out there down in, but down in the States, it's like a $10 jerk bait.
Okay.
And honestly, it's incredible for a $10 jerk bait.
Really?
It's pretty close to most Japanese jerk baits I've used out there. And, you know, if.
All right. I'm writing that down. What's it called? You're going to make me spend a bunch of money now. Yuzuri?
It's the Yuzuri. It's in their 3DB lineup. And it's just the 110 jerk bait. And they got a 110 deep model.
Ah, nice.
Yeah. Yeah. So they got two models and just the right size. Yeah, 110 size is perfect. You know, there's lots of big, you know, Vision 110 fans out there for Mega Bass. And again, a great jerk bait, but you know, you can buy three of these Yuzuris for one Mega Bass.
Right. Right. No, so, I agree. Good stuff. So I know you do a lot of stuff as far as bass fishing and media and whatnot, David. How can people follow you and see what you have going on throughout the season? What's the best way?
Sure. Well, you can find me on Facebook, David Chong, Fish Hard Dream Big, and on you know, Instagram at Fish Hard, and on Twitter at Fish Hard Dave. So it's I usually will respond to private messages there pretty quickly if you need to contact me there. If I don't, it's because I'm practicing for a tournament or in a tournament. That's the only time I won't respond, you know, fairly quickly. So if you don't hear from me a couple of days, just assume I'm in a tournament.
Right. Exactly. Well, yeah. David, thanks so much for joining us. Fascinating. We could talk another 3 hours. Unfortunately,
listen, you know. when it comes talking smallmouth fishing, we can go on. We never even got into drop shotting or
throwing
a tube or Ned rigging or Carolina rigging. You know, there's, you know, we could do a whole second show just on those presentations.
Yeah, know? Absolutely. I in fact, I'm gonna put this offer out there. I'd like to have you come on our YouTube live show at some point here and really dig into some of those topics, because there's so much going on. I mean, I can tell you could sit down and do a 2-hour seminar on jerkbaits alone. You know?
I've done many of them. Yeah, I've done many of them. And most time I leave people scratching their heads and, you know.
Exactly. Well, I'm going to definitely try these Yozuris. I'm going to try to make that bait turn around, and I'm also going to try the long lining. That's what I got out of this conversation. So I learned something new every week. I know the viewers and listeners do as well. So thank you very much, David.
And you should. If anybody out there, I assume if you're like me and we're always, and I know you are, we're always striving to be better. We're always striving to be better. So if you're not open-minded and willing to try different things, I'm always looking to add presentations, you know, try different baits and stuff like that. You know, you do the same old all the time, you're going to have some success, but you're not going to have that consistent day in, day out success that, especially when you're coming to smallmouth who are constantly changing.
Well, thanks, David, for joining us. Thank you, the viewers and listeners.
My privilege.
Yep. And as always, until next time, we'll see you guys on the water.
Okay. Honored. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening today. Make sure that you're subscribed to the show and follow us on Instagram at Smallmouth Crush. Also, the YouTube channel, Smallmouth Crush. And if you feel so inclined, please leave us a 5-star rating and comment with a review below. And as always, until next time, we'll see you on the water.